good to be with you today. The book of 2 Timothy is a unique letter in the New Testament. It is nostalgic in its tone, a rather personal letter, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that it's Paul's last letter, at least the last one that we have. Paul had been seized, shackled, and confined in the city of Rome, chained like a criminal, among the felons in the dungeon where the air stank and sanitation was non-existent, and lonely to the bone, he writes in the beginning of 2 Timothy, "To Timothy, my dearly beloved son." This might cause some to ask, was Timothy Paul's physical son, the son of Paul and his wife? And the answer, of course, is no. He was not, and we know that he wasn't. When we look back at the 16th chapter of the book of Acts, which was from a time about 15 years before 2 Timothy was written, also many, many miles and several pints of blood before 2 Timothy was written, when we go back to Acts 16 and that second missionary journey when Paul and Silas stopped at Lystra, we're introduced to Timothy there. He's called a disciple whose mother was a Jewess, but his father was a Greek. So Timothy's real physical father was ethnically different from Timothy's mother and also spiritually different from his mother. An unbelieving Greek father he had physically. But Timothy is there in Acts 16 called a disciple. He was already a disciple. Paul had been to this same area of Lystra on the first missionary journey. And there's almost no question but what Timothy was at that time converted by Paul. Because those were the kinds of people that Paul looked at as his spiritual children. As he said to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 4:15, "You may have 10,000 instructors in Christ, but you have not many fathers, for in Christ Jesus I have begotten you through the gospel." He begot them by planting the seed and having that seed germinate, take root, and develop, and a birth take place. So when he writes to somebody as his son in the faith, he's almost without question talking to somebody that he himself has converted. So Paul calls Timothy his son. Timothy was a disciple, he was well spoken of, and Paul then wanted him to travel with him, and he did, and became a very close associate of Paul. All that background that you know about concerning Timothy and Paul and their relationship wraps around the letter that we call 2 Timothy. At this time, when 2 Timothy is written, Timothy is at the zenith of his career. Paul is at the end of his. And in that dripping, dank dungeon, Paul writes and says in 2 Timothy 1, verse 3, "I constantly remember you in my prayers night and day." And in verse 4, he says, "longing to see you, greatly desiring to see you." One of the things that we would like to know but don't know is whether Timothy got to Paul before Paul was beheaded. We'd like to think that he did. We can't think that on anything other than an emotional level because we just don't have any information about it. Maybe someday. I suspect that someday we'll know more about that than we do now. But Paul was longing to see him, and surely Timothy was longing to see Paul. I'd like for us to notice in this letter of 2 Timothy some things that were apparently indelible impressions made by that mother of Timothy upon the mark, upon the life of her son. Five marks upon the life of her offspring. These are seeds that mothers plant in the lives of their children, and may these seeds never stop being planted. These are your unique contributions to your children, mothers. Number one is tenderness. Because Paul goes on here in verse 4 and says, "being mindful of thy tears." Paul was mindful of the tears of Timothy, perhaps when they had been separated from each other and knew that they wouldn't be together again for a long time, if ever. Back before the times when a telephone call or a videotape could be almost like being there. To be separated from somebody in that uncertain, uncommunicative world meant that you might never see them again. And some of you have lived through times that were almost like that. It wasn't uncommon 50 years ago when somebody moved to California, you just expected never to see them again in many instances. Today, that's largely lost for the present generation, but if you've been around a long time, you'd have a greater grasp of the tear, of what may have prompted the tears that Paul is talking about. Maybe it was somebody else, something else that prompted those tears. Maybe problems in the church prompted them. Whatever it was, there was a tenderness in Timothy that prompted him to cry, and Paul remembered that when he wrote the letter we call 2 Timothy. A tenderness. Probably transmitted to Timothy by his mother. That's where most of us get it. The consideration, sympathy, helpfulness, tact, courtesy, compassion, unselfishness, politeness, understanding, thoughtfulness, manners. These are things we learn from our mothers. These are the attractive qualities of tenderness which help transform little girls and boys into ladies and gentlemen. Lincoln was right. No man is really poor who has had a godly mother. They teach us these things through their own tenderness, often expressed in tears. So don't stop crying, mothers. I'm not saying to fake it, but don't stop it when it's genuine. This is a necessary part of the tender, motherly characteristic. It has its place. And Paul remembered Timothy's tears. Number two, a sincere faith. This is verse 5. When I call to remembrance the unfeigned, the genuine, the sincere faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also. An unhypocritical faith. I remember, Timothy, how authentic your faith is. That it's not faith, it's real. I have no man like-minded, he said to the Corinthians one time. Remember that? He was talking about who he could send to see them. And he said, I'm going to send Timothy. I've got nobody like him. A lot of people working with me and for me in the gospel, but I've got nobody like Timothy. Faith solid as a rock. Where did Timothy get that faith? Paul goes here into the roots of Timothy's life, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and in thy mother Eunice, and I'm persuaded that it's in you too. Timothy didn't originate it. He was marked by this faith. Almost by the process of osmosis, this faith was transmitted from grandmother to mother to son. It was learned, not inherent. He absorbed it as he discovered it modeled in the life of his mother. Does your mother have an authentic faith, one that's solid as a rock? If she does, and had that while you were growing up, chances are you have a similar faith. If she wasn't, chances are you picked that characteristic up also. There's no more significant influence than that of a mother in the life of her child. Simple faith, not a lot of words about it necessarily, but a simple, faithful life that you can count on, solid as a rock. Timothy was nurtured with the Scriptures. We find that over a couple chapters later in the same book, chapter 3, verses 13 and 14. He there says, and I'll just read that. In 2 Timothy 3, verses 13 and 14. Continue thou, I'm reading verse 14, continue thou in the things which thou hast learned and been assured of, knowing of whom thou hast learned them, that from a child thou hast known the holy Scriptures, which are able to make thee wise unto salvation, through faith which is in Christ Jesus. He was nurtured with the Scriptures. He knew them from a child. And he says here then, back in verse 13, evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. Timothy, you're there in the city of Ephesus, surrounded by fakes, phonies, and charlatans. They're all over Ephesus. But be different, Timothy. You are different. Remember the authenticity that marked your roots. Remember how you can make judgments about what these people are doing and saying. From a child, you've known the Holy Scriptures. The mention of a grandparent back here in chapter 1, verse 5, might be of encouragement to some of you. Because grandparents also can leave an indelible mark on their grandchildren, and they tend to. Mine certainly did on me. They had room in their busy lives for their little grandson. And for me, going to visit them was just like heaven on earth. Returning to Bramer was almost like returning to the womb. It was that comfortable. Out on that farm, when the electricity would go off, the only way we had of telling time was Grandpa's watch, but then we didn't really need to tell time. We grew most of our own food. There was just no reason to go anywhere, and so we didn't. Almost like a cocoon, apart from the rest of life. And I laid on the living room floor of that little house that my grandfather built for $800 and read the Old Testament. Time so great it almost aches to remember them. I just wonder if Timothy didn't have some of those kinds of memories with his grandmother. Somehow, in the childhood days of Timothy's life, there was a mark made. I had a mother who stayed home and raised me. I had a mother who read me Bible stories endlessly. We just finished reading the story of Samson, and I'd say, let's read it again. So she'd read it again. I'll never forget the sound of her voice reading those words as long as I remember anything. She stayed home and bothered to do that. From a child thou hast known the Holy Scriptures. The other day somebody was asking, how long was Samson a judge over Israel? The amazing thing to me was not that I knew it, but that other people in the room didn't know it. Because it seems like there never was a time I didn't know that. And there's only one person responsible for that fact in this room today. It certainly isn't me. The implementation of faith occurs through the hands and the hearts and the minds and the tongues of godly mothers. It makes a mark. Number three, not only Timothy's tenderness, not only his sincere faith, but also his sense of inner confidence, apparently were transmitted by this woman. Down in verse 7, I believe the word for there, for God hath not given us spirit of fear, refers this back to the grandmother and the mother he's already been talking about. God has not given us the spirit of timidity, shyness, a sense of inferiority or intimidation, but a spirit of power, inherent strength, inner might, confidence. It would seem that the four links this back to the mother and the grandmother. God gives us confidence through our roots. Parents can be the destroyers of confidence, too, or they can fail to build it up. A mother can build a sense of inner self-worth in the life of his or of her child. Fathers are involved in this, too. Parents unite in bringing this about. Dobson, in his book that he wrote a long time ago, Hide or Seek, wrote about the cult of beauty and the cult of intelligence, making the point that if you've got a child that's beautiful, or if you've got a child that's brilliant, then the world says this person is worthy. But if you have a child that doesn't look too good or isn't too smart, then this is the place where the parents play an extremely important role. And most of us have, in our families, children who aren't really brilliant and who aren't very beautiful, but they have everything that God gave them, and it's parents' responsibility to see that and draw it out and say, this is significant. You can make a unique contribution to the people around you in the world. I believe we should reject the notion that feelings of inferiority, feelings of inadequacy are necessarily inevitable. I'm not so sure that that's true. Self-doubt, at least as a lifestyle, is not unavoidable. Teach your children what their genuine significance is, regardless of the shape of his nose or the efficiency of his brain. Your tone, as well as your terms, help to shape that day by day. We can destroy self-worth or we can build it up. You can destroy or remove confidence by the way you say what you say. You can criticize and criticize and criticize until confidence is just gone. And you've raised an inadequate little man wondering what life's all about and waiting for his wife to tell him what to do. Number four, love. Verse 7 as well. The spirit of love, a demonstrative doing of what is good for another. Inherent in agape is this concept of unselfishness. Doing something for the highest good of another. Where do we learn that? Our mother is our first model of unselfishness. As a baby in the crib, we cry out in the night, and who comes? Dad? Not at our house, not usually. Almost invariably, in most homes, I believe it's the mother. More often than not. The child remembers that demonstrative love that just kept on coming and kept on coming. The staying power throughout all the exasperating tasks of childhood. And if you've raised them, you know it's exasperating. What do I owe my mother? Can it even be calculated? I owe her for her time, day after day and night after night. I owe her for her example, consistent and dependable, for her support, stimulating and encouraging and challenging, for her humor, sparkling and witty, for her counsel, wise and quiet, for her humility, genuine and gracious. Her hospitality, smiling and warm. Her insight, keen and honest. Her flexibility, patient and joyful. I owe her for her faith, solid and sure. For her hope, ceaseless and indestructible. For her love, devoted and deep. We've talked about a tenderness, a transparent tenderness that's not afraid to cry. An authentic faith, an inner confidence, a demonstrative love. The last thing is self-control. God has given us the spirit of a sound mind, self-control. Again, verse 5 of chapter 1. And perhaps this is the rarest thing of all. Self-mastery. Self-discipline. Self-rule. God has not given us through our roots a spirit of timidity, but of confidence, love, and self-control. The ability to say no when the great majority says yes. The ability to say yes when everyone else is saying no. The mother's goal of helping the child come to know himself. Beginning when the child is just little, with those faithful reproofs. No, no, don't touch. You'll get your hand slapped if you touch that again. Clear on up to where we're young people, and she still hesitantly is saying, I really don't think that's too wise, honey. And she doesn't want to be a plague or a nag, but she can't bear to see you make what she knows is a mistake, perhaps because she made it herself when she was young. Ultimately, that child learns to control himself or herself. There was a study done a number of years ago. 1,738 middle-class boys and their families were the focus of this study, beginning in pre-adolescent times and following them through to young manhood. The boys who had the higher sense of self-esteem and self-control were clearly more loved and more appreciated at home. They came from parents who were significantly more strict in their approach to discipline. Because the parents of the low esteem group, apparently by the lack of concern for discipline, had created an insecurity. They created a dependence by their permissiveness. And their children were more likely to feel that the rules were not enforced simply because nobody cared enough to enforce them. Nobody cared enough to really be involved day to day in their lives. The homes of the high esteem boys were also characterized by an openness of expression. Once the boundaries for behavior were established, there was a freedom for individual personalities to develop and grow. And the boys could express themselves without fear, without ridicule, but they knew what the rules were, and they knew they needed to keep those rules no matter how they felt about the rules. But there was an overall atmosphere marked by acceptance and emotional safety. Mothers, you are the turnkey, the touchstone, the secret to so much. Tenderness, faith, confidence, love, self-discipline. There's something about motherhood that gives mothers a perspective and an insight which men just don't seem to have. Men have other things that the women don't have. But that, perhaps that 9-month head start that pregnancy gives tends to teach the mother feelings and knowledge of the child before her husband ever has that. And there seems to be a mutual bonding there. I don't believe in the first year of a child's life, he hardly knows who his father is. I've had 3 of them. I don't think they hardly knew. I don't think it would have mattered much whether I stopped going around or not. That's a little bit of an overstatement. But the mother was their world for that first 6 months or year. They knew who mama was. I believe that Timothy's mother, like many of the mothers in this auditorium this morning, had taken to heart the truths that are on that plaque that I've seen on so many of your walls and taped up on so many refrigerators. That if a child learns with criticism, he learns to condemn. If he lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If he lives with ridicule, he learns to be shy. If he lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. If he lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. If he lives with encouragement, he learns confidence. If he lives with praise, he learns to appreciate. If he lives with fairness, he learns justice. If he lives with security, he learns to have faith. If he lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If he lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world. Very wise man once said, and it's written down in Proverbs 24, by wisdom a house is built, by understanding it is established, and by knowledge the rooms are filled with precious and pleasant riches. Tenderness, faith, confidence, love, and discipline. Thank you, mothers, and please keep it up. We conclude this morning by extending the Lord's invitation. If you need to respond to it, try Jesus. As we stand and sing, let us know what your needs are.
You have trod the path of worldly pleasure, sought for peace the world can never give.